Hello! In this episode of University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff, I talk to someone who is very much not a registrar, but a notable figure nevertheless. Dr. Vince Wilson recently retired as an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, and among the stuff we learn about is Vince's distinctive academic journey from a first degree in pharmacy to a research degree, a Royal Society fellowship, as part of which he spent a period in Germany, and then a postdoc in Glasgow. Vince joined Nottingham in 1989 when he was based at the Queen's Medical Centre building, and being in the same building as a hospital was a big attraction, particularly for translational research. We discuss some of the differences in scale and technology in higher education since the 80s, but also the increased pressure on academics during that time. Other significant developments which Vince highlights are the outreach and widening participation agenda, which he's involved in, and the specific transnational medical education partnership with Thailand, which had delivered strong results over many years, as well as enabling him to enjoy a period of work in the sun during the cold winter months. Vince's passion for music has been ever present throughout his career, as well as providing a vehicle for engaging with the public when he was a locum pharmacist and students in the classroom. He highlights the hitherto largely underreported contribution of one of his heroes, the late great Gil Scott Heron, to academia. However, it is to Miles Davis and John Coltrane he turns for his priority Desert Island disc selection. It's a really different and entertaining conversation, and I'm sure you will enjoy it. Welcome, everyone. My name's Paul Greatrix, and in this, the latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, I'm actually talking to someone who very much is not a registrar, but someone who I've been privileged to call a friend and a colleague for a number of years now, who's Dr. Vince Wilson, who's recently retired from the University of Nottingham as Associate Professor and Reader in Autonomic Pharmacology in the School of Life Sciences here at the University of Nottingham, after a long and distinguished career in this university and elsewhere. We'll hear about a bit more about that in a minute. But anyway, welcome, Vince. It's a great honour and pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Paul, for the opportunity to talk about life, university, and music. Yeah.
So that's a distinctive, well, many distinctive things about Vince is that music has played a big part in his life and career, but we'll talk about a bit about that in a minute. But I did want specifically to talk to Vince, A, because he's just retired, but B, because he's got such a wide range of perspectives on university life and higher education, which I've never encountered a combination like it in anyone else I've ever worked with or come across in our sector. So I was very, very keen to persuade him. Well, to be honest, it didn't take an awful lot of persuading, but I was very keen to persuade him to have a chat as part of the podcast. So, Vince, just to give people a flavour of your academic career, can you kind of summarise your journey to from starting through to retirement in a nutshell?
Yeah, I suppose I made a decision when I was 18 to do a degree in pharmacy, and I did that at Aston University. And for me and most of my colleagues at the time, the obvious route was either into hospital pharmacy or into retail pharmacy at that time. And the truth is, by the time I got to the third year, I realised that that's not really for me, but I loved the research project that I did. And I had a conversation, the supervisor approached me and said, have you thought about doing research? And I'd never really thought about it, but I did a pre-reg as a pharmacist for a year, and then 6 months working, and then managed to get a BBSRC studentship, and then embarked upon 3 years of research from that point on. And that led me to really live in Germany for a year. I got a Royal Society fellowship to work in Germany. When I came back from Germany, I then had about 9 months or so working in a pharmacy. And that's one of the great things about the sort of choice that I made, is that at any point I could just say, I don't want to do that. I'll go back and do pharmacy. But the person who vivid me from a PhD was from Glasgow, and he obviously enjoyed the conversation that we had. And about 6 months after I returned from Germany, he says, I've got a job for you up in Glasgow. So I did a postdoc up there for 3 years, and then I came to Nottingham 1989, to work in what was then the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology, as a lecturer, as in sort of cardiovascular, smooth muscle type interest in terms of research. One of the lovely things about Nottingham is, and the institution that I worked in, which was school, effectively the School of Medicine over at the Queen's Medical Centre, is that building, which I think is best part of nearly 55 years old, I think is very different from most hospital university type relationships with medical schools, in so much that I could walk from my office and go and speak to clinicians in the hospital. I didn't need to leave the building.
Yeah.
And I have to say, over the years, then with a variety of different clinicians, I think that that's the reason why, to a degree, I've stayed in this city, because when opportunities have come elsewhere, when I've looked elsewhere at various stages of my career, it didn't have what QMC currently has. And that's a very, very positive thing for me.
So 34 years, that is quite a long time.
It is.
In one institution.
Yeah.
But the university, and indeed the higher education sector in 1989, was very, very different from what it is now. So what's, you know, looking back on those days, what kind of things have you noticed about the differences in, you know, work and life and academic life?
Well, I think higher education has expanded considerably since 1989. So the number of medical students, the number of pharmacy students, and indeed the number of scientists, those who are doing science degrees, have increased out of all recognition in truth. And that's been a challenge, and we like to be challenged. We're scientists, we're researchers, we want to grow from that. And I think that's been a really good thing, to actually see new people, new ideas arrive, and the various changes in the structure of the university. Myself and colleagues would say there are some really good things about it, but actually in hindsight, there were some things that I'm not entirely sure that they worked for us.
Yeah.
They worked for the system, but they didn't necessarily work for us. And academics, as you know, Paul, always complain about stuff. Yeah.
Well, and no one likes change, obviously.
No, I do like change. Yeah.
But okay, so scale was one thing. I mean, I think the, kind of technologically, things were very different back then as well, weren't they?
There were technologically, it was very different in terms of research wise. The truth is that the basic things that I was doing as a PhD student, as a postdoc, and then when I came here, actually that sort of technique and approach to things remains in place. And indeed, here in Nottingham, we've sort of built on that sort of approach, which is really just largely working with isolated smooth muscle. And actually, we now have, the School of Life Sciences has, a degree in pharmacology in which it's based on that. So that technology remains in place, but clearly there are a whole set of other things. And I mentioned the clinicians that I've done work with. That's just opened things up and just helped me to grow as an individual. It's just a great environment to deal with the sort of what we call translational research.
Yeah.
You know, drugs, novel compounds, testing them, and then eventually looking at not necessarily novel compounds, but established compounds, looking at what that does in man with a variety of different techniques.
And that's where all the advances come from in contemporary contemporary medicine. So on the going back to areas that I understand, the working life must have, I mean, there's always a kind of temptation to have a kind of golden age nostalgia about the, you know, the lovely times when we were all younger in universities and everything was just a lot easier and, you know, people could, you know, knock off early on a Friday and all that kind of stuff, right? But, and there was, you know, my recollections are that there's an element of truth in that, and that's, you know, there were different pressures though. And, I mean, again, reflecting back on the way things have changed in the past 30 years, I mean, do you think life is materially worse for, you know, typical academic colleagues or researchers than it was, you know, all that time ago?
Yeah, I think the pressure on colleagues is greater than before, and also an internal expectation of what they would do. And you know me well enough, and I'd say, chill. Right, that would be my response to things. But I do see colleagues under pressure, self-created and from outside, in a way that I didn't see 30-odd years ago. What I'll share with you, even though I've retired, I do have one PhD student remaining, and I've sort of, and she's got to submit, I think, May or maybe June of next year, and there's just a few experiments that need doing. So actually I've got a deal with her that I will be her technician, and we agree on experiments, and I've gone back to what I did when I first arrived and what I did as a postdoc, and I have to say it's a real blessing. So and people are saying, Vince, I see more of you now than I ever did. You're never in your office and stuff. Yeah, that's the response. And actually, that for me gives or brings a lot of pleasure being able to do that. And I'm reminded of why I chose not to go down the pharmacy route and why I chose an academic and a research route.
But one of the things that, again, has changed and developed or evolved over the past period, which you were actively involved in, is the kind of university approach to outreach activity, to engaging with people who's, you know, from various disadvantaged backgrounds, whose first thought may not have been, I'm going to go to higher education, whose parents won't necessarily have been engaged in higher education, who, you know, didn't know the opportunities that might exist for them. And you've been very active in different ways, haven't you?
Well, I have and I haven't. In some respects, I have helped a little bit in terms of the medicine course in the widening participation. But I haven't, I mean, the truth is that they do a brilliant job over in the medical school. And I've given some advice. I am involved in the I was involved in the admissions committee associated with that. And I would do some things to actually, some talks to people to encourage them and just give them a different perspective. So these are 16 to 18 year olds. But the truth is, I hadn't really done as much as perhaps I could have done. I could have pushed in that direction a lot more. And if I reflect upon it, perhaps I didn't do as much as I could have done. What I am involved in now, which relates to the area of Nottingham that I live in, which is known as the Meadows, or if you live in Nottingham, it's Meadows. But in that area, which is near Trent Bridge, we are doing some Saturday morning sort of science-based sessions, and I'm organised with help from colleagues to do these sessions, and actually that's an incredibly positive experience. So that's called the Saffron Science Club, and it's something that we want to develop.
But that's about developing aspirations.
That's absolutely
for for kids, particularly who wouldn't have thought that university could ever be for them. And helping, and particularly as well, science could never be for them.
Yeah.
And I do think that kind of thing is really important. So good on you for doing that. And I mean, just to be clear, you know, the Meadows is one of those more disadvantaged areas in the city of Nottingham where the staying on rates won't be great. And, you know, try and make a difference there.
Yeah.
One of the other changes has been in the international outlook of the universities. And, you know, this university in Nottingham in particular has had, you know, over particularly the past 20 or so years, has developed a very strong international outlook, particularly through its international footprint in Malaysia and China. But you've been involved in different dimensions of internationalisation in your time, haven't you?
I have. And all this goes back, I think, the best part of 20 years to a colleague, Professor Charles Marsden, who set up something very original, a novel joint medical program with a university in Bangkok, Thailand. And this was born of some postgraduate students who came to do a PhD in Nottingham, returned to Thailand, and then approached Charles to set this up. And just for those listening, the novelty here is that in Thailand, the medical degree is 6 years compared to the UK, which is generally 5 years. And we run here in Nottingham, a BMed Sci degree, which runs for 3 years. And then the students embark on their main clinical training. And that's different from many other universities in the UK. Charles showed our colleagues in Thailand the model that we've got, the fact that you can get a degree after 3 years. They like the idea of that, and the fact that the students get a period of 3-4 months of research. And colleagues in Thailand thought it would be great to actually have some students come to Nottingham, do the BMed Sci, and then return to Thailand to do their 3 years of clinical training. So he set that up in 2003, and then he retired in 2007, and he approached me to actually take that on. And I have to say that there are many positive things about the sort of research career and things like that that I've been involved in. But this represented a very different sort of direction. And I have to say I'm blessed that I'm blessed in, this sounds funny, I'm blessed in the sense that in winter, whether it was December or maybe January, when the skies are dark, I would have to travel all the way to Thailand. And it was nice and warm and be there for a week, maybe 10 days, interviewing and then visiting various places. And the truth is that that has grown over the last 16, 17 years. And I think the link is a very strong one that we've developed with our colleagues in Thailand. And I repeat, I feel blessed as a result.
But I think it's a really interesting example of how, you know, almost a happenstance connection can emerge, and then you build on it and you engage. But I mean, it is very much a partnership, isn't it? And it is something that where both partners do have some real, you know, a real stake in the game, and actually, you know, it means something to both sides. So it's not a kind of unbalanced.
No. This is something we. In going over each year to do the interviews, and I do this with one colleague from Nottingham, is that we had to understand the journey of the students, and we had to understand the Thai medical education system. And one of the nice things about it is that Senakarin Wirat University, who we have the joint medical program with, I think when it started, it was deemed to be not a particularly high university within Thailand. So Mahidol and Chulalongkorn are much bigger, like Oxford and Cambridge. But what's interesting is that they have now looked at our model, and they've reached out to universities in, I think in London, they're trying to do something similar to that. But I think COVID then happened, and so that sort of taken a backseat for them.
Yeah.
But it's quite clear that the idea that Charles Marsden had to develop this is something that remains novel, and remains of interest to many students who live in Thailand. They want the experience of living in the UK, and Nottingham provides that.
But also as an exemplar of, I mean, part of one of the things about transnational education is that it has to be by its very nature long-term, right? And actually there's been a genuine long-term commitment by the university, as exemplified by you, also your successor. But actually that really, really matters in terms of ensuring that, you know, the partners have confidence that it will continue and that it's worthwhile. Because you can't be in it just for money or just for, you know, a bit of a headline every now and then. You've got to be in it for the long-term and recognise that, you know, everyone gets something out of it. And you've got to sustain it.
Yeah, what I would say, Paul, one of the important things right at the beginning within the Thai medical education system, because of the way in which Thailand is that the big universities would do all their clinical training in urban areas. And when we first started with Senakarin Wirat University, what they wanted was for the students, when they return, to actually go out and do things clinically in rural areas. So their clinical hospital is something like 50 miles outside of Bangkok in a very rural area, but it's a massive hospital that deals with a large area. And we used to say to the students, because, and you'll appreciate this, is that they are from wealthy backgrounds. They have the choice of going to do their medical education in the United States, Canada, Australia.
Yeah.
Question is, why come to Nottingham? And we would impress upon them that what we want, our belief system, was you've got to go out and help all people in Thailand, not just those that are in the rich urban areas.
Yeah.
And so that for me was a very positive thing to be involved in at that time.
No, I think it's an exemplary model, and it's worked extremely well for the university. And but part of it, I think, is down to that long-term involvement of yourself in ensuring it continued. And obviously you got some sunshine in December and January.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I would say my vitamin D levels would definitely increase. In spite of my melanin content, I know for a fact that my vitamin D content increased when I got back in February.
So one of the other elements I mentioned at the beginning, that, you know, kind of music's played a big part in your life generally, and I mean, one of the interesting things that you've done in the university is suggest a couple of very musical figures, proposed them, and they have been awarded honorary degrees in the university: Giles Peterson, the DJ and producer, but also Don Letts, the, you know, video music producer, singer, and all-round artiste. And, you know, both of them remarkable figures. But you know, I think that I was particularly inspired by Don Letts, who's someone I remember from my youth in his early days, and just thinking, here's a remarkable individual who it's fantastic for the university to be honouring in this way.
Yeah.
But he was someone quite extraordinary. But these are just a couple of your, you know, suggestions, and indeed, I wouldn't go as far as to say heroes, but certainly notable figures that you regard as impressive in the world of music. But how, beyond honorary degrees then, is my very long-winded way to get into this question, but how would you say music has intersected with your university life and your academic life in any way at all? I mean, you've had lots of engagements with students as musicians, but also people who you spent inordinate amount of time talking to about music. So talk us a bit through music in your life.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that I did a pharmacy degree, and I did work in a hospital for a year, and actually I then worked for 6 months after that. And actually during my academic career, I continued to do locums as a pharmacist, and I helped a friend out in Birmingham. He helped me out as well. One of the nice things about that is that it allowed me to move out of academia and just relate to people. So yes, I'm providing them with medicines in my role as a pharmacist, but on a Saturday morning, there would also be lots of conversations about football, about life, about music. And actually, I learned from that at a very early stage that if you can get either art, music, football, if you can engage with people in that way, separate from your professional role, you get them on your side. And my experience is that with students, same things apply. So as I've got older, then inevitably they come and they look at you and they, ooh, it's Dr. Wilson, you know, that sort of response. And they don't know how to engage.
Yeah.
But actually you can break a lot of that down by finding out what their interests are in terms of either films, TV, music. And actually, I've always used that as a way to engage with students. And I'd have to say it works.
I absolutely get that. But it's also, you know, I'm pushing you in a particular direction, which is to share some further of your thoughts. Because, I mean, although this isn't a kind of Desert Island Discs thing, right?
Yeah.
I am interested in, you know, the kind of the bits of music that are most important to you. I mean, you've often said that, you know, one of your musical heroes is Gil Scott-Heron, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, would you say that, you know, he is the most important influence on your, you know, in terms of a musician on your life, or is it a bit more subtle?
No, Gil Scott-Heron is very important, don't get me wrong, but I have two sons. The Aaron, the eldest, his middle name is Davis, and my second son, Nathaniel, his middle name is Coltrane. And that probably tells you everything in terms of my real heroes, in terms of music. So having made that decision nearly 40 odd years ago with Aaron and 35 odd years ago with Nathaniel, that tells you where my head has been all that time. And it hasn't changed. They're just tremendous individuals. I'm blessed that I've had that. But Gil Scott-Heron, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Gil Scott-Heron has taught me a lot and forced me to reflect upon things. I'm sort of upset now just talking about it because of the sad way in which he died. But he's an academic. You know, Gil Scott-Heron was an academic. If you listen to H2O Gate Blues, written in 1973, written March 1973, recorded in October 73, Nixon resigned the August in 74. Gil Scott-Heron looked at things, analysed it, and actually put those words together in a rap. Just incredible. No one has ever done that. Yeah. So that's Gil Scott-Heron's influence on me.
So, and have you been able to persuade anyone else of the this influence of him on academia?
I've used Gil Scott-Heron in lectures.
Right.
Yeah. So I used to do a series of lectures on substance misuse as a pharmacist.
Yeah.
I deal with things like that. And I used to do a lecture in which I'd incorporate Gil Scott-Heron's words. So students would be exposed to it. Home is where the hatred is. And it would be in there. And if you look at the lyrics from Gil Scott-Heron talking about substance misuse, addiction, you have to understand how people get to that particular point. His words say that. I've also used Gil Scott-Heron in the context of, and because I was on the Research Ethics Committee, Gil Scott-Heron wrote a song called Tuskegee 626, which is just, can't be more than it's no more than a minute. It's probably 40 seconds or so. But I'd never heard of Tuskegee and why it was significant. But Gil Scott-Heron taught me that. And the significance of it is that prior to the Second World War, an experiment was started on black men who had syphilis, and with all the good reasons at the time to do it. And that experiment, what they had a research plan, and it continued, and they're just looking at outcomes in men who had syphilis. And they provided transport for people, and they provided some food for people if they came to the meetings. There's a film about this as well. And I'd never heard about this at all, but Gil Scott-Heron documented that and the ethics associated with it, because penicillin was available in the late 1940s and it was known to be effective against syphilis. And the people who were responsible for the study, and that includes the black people in Tuskegee who was running the study, they just continued. They didn't offer those men and their family a way of treating the condition. They just looked at the endpoints in 1960. And Gil Scott-Heron wrote about that. And it wasn't until I came to Nottingham that I really looked at it, and I'm involved in ethics, and I started talking about the Tuskegee experiment that was done and why ethically it was wrong.
So it's really interesting, because I had heard about that, but obviously not made the Gil Scott-Heron connection. But the but I think all of those points show the really interesting intersections between music and, you know, your academic life, and also your son's names as well. if you were if this were Desert Island Discs and you were able to take one record with you, or keep one record on your desert island, which one would it be? Would it be
what one?
Would
record?
It be Miles Davis or would it be John Coltrane?
Oh,
or would it be
no? I wouldn't have to choose between them, because I would say Love for Sale, and Miles Davis and John Coltrane are on the track.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
So if it was just one track, right, okay, I would say Love for Sale, as one in which both my sons can claim.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to show that you'd chosen between them. Listen, Vince, we need to stop there, but I want to thank you so much for having the chat. It's been really enlightening.
You're welcome, Paul. I've enjoyed it, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.